Please. Good morning. We spend, I think, 2.5 lectures in discussing in detail the combinatorial and algebraic structure of perturbation theory, how it is organized, how you manipulate the Feynman diagrams. And it was an important part of the course because you have to really understand how this perturbation theory rules work. But of course, we didn't did almost any physics from now, up to now. We have been discussing the signification of the effective action, and I show you that the effective action tells you, gives you information about the properties of the vacuum. For instance, what is the expectation value of the field operator in the vacuum, but that's something which is important, but of course, that's not all of the physics of a quantum field theory. So now we start to discuss the physical significance of the correlation function, and especially the problem of pronormalization, why you have ultraviolet divergences, and how we can deal with them in a physical theory. So we start to discuss. Normalization theory. And again, in the context of the phi 4 scalar field theory. Of course, we'll discuss later on, later gauge theories. But at the moment, we still discuss the simple theory of a single scalar field with no charge and just self-interacting. Okay. So first, before discussing normalization theory, I want to discuss a little bit, without any proof, an important properties of quantum field theory, which is what is the relation between the two-point correlation function namely, what is the propagator? What is the relation between this and the spectrum of the theory? So, which information can you get out of the particle content of the theory and the content of state of a quantum field theory out of a simple object, which is a two-point correlation function? And there is a very important formula, which is called the Chern-Lehmann spectral representation, which is a very nice formula which relates those two. And I presume, but I'm not sure that you heard about this formula in the QFT1 course. Did you? Or does this name, Chern-Lehmann spectral representation, tell something to you? No? Okay, so I explain it a little bit. Well, Chern is or was a Swedish physicist, so I hope I pronounce his name well, and Lehmann was a famous German physicist. Okay, so remember, the two-point correlation function in Minkowski space is defined by the vacuum expectation value of the time-ordered product of two field operators. Okay, so this is the vacuum of the theory state, and these are the field operators. So I put big field to indicate that those are operators. Field operators. And I'm considering this in an interacting theory. So we know that this is a function of x minus y, so you can always write it in terms of Fourier transform or d of k, where this will be a four momenta. I am supposed to be, I am in four dimension. E to the I k dot x minus y. This is a scalar product of four momenta. And you have the Fourier transform of the propagator, which is the representation of the full propagator in Fourier space. So what I'm considering is a function like that, no, which is a function of k, which is given by the sum, for instance, of all the propagator of the theory. So it's not just the free propagator, it's the sum of all the diagram which contributes to the two-point correlation function. Okay. And you know that in the free theory, for instance, for the free theory, g hat of k is minus I over k squared plus m squared, where m is the mass of the theory, and there is a minus I epsilon. And remember that with my notation, k squared is minus e squared plus the form menta, where if k is e k, with e positive, of course. Okay, so that's my notation. So you see that in the free theory, let me call it G naught. This is the mass of the particle in the free theory, and this is the propagator in the free theory. So G equals zero. The propagator has a simple form. Now, in fact, there is for any interacting theory, there is a generalization of this formula. And let me explain what it is. First, let me look at the spectrum of the theory. Here I represent the momentum k, and here I represent the energy, i.e. spectrum of the theory. And you know that in the free theory, in the momentum energy space, the physical state for the free theory is given by k squared equal minus m naught squared, because the energy has to be equal to square root of m zero squared plus k squared. This is simply the Einstein E equal mc two relation, but remember that c is equal to one. So this is simply a way to write E equal mc2 for a relativistic particle. And so this means that, in fact, here I represent the E equal k. The states, the one particle state, are points in this k E space on this hyperbola. Okay? And this relation is called the mass shell of this line, which is, of course, in fact, it's a three-dimensional surface in four dimensions, but here I have just one momenta and one heat. So this is called the mass shell. Okay? And of course, it's a hyperbola which starts at energy equal m. So this is a particle at rest, not moving, its energy is proportional to its mass. And here, this state describes the particles which moves with some momenta equal k. Okay? But that's not the only, possible energy eigenstate of the particle, because, of course, describes one particle state. Okay? But in the in general, you may have also a state where you have several particles, okay? And a state with two particles, for instance, has an energy of 2m. Okay. So you have other states, and you may have other particles. So you may, in fact, you have other states which can be either many particle states or excited states. And bound states. In an interacting theory, you may have bound state of the particles, etc. But of course, because of relativistic invariance, if you have a complicated state made out of several particles, okay, it always has a mass. Let us call it mu at rest. Okay, and if we move it, its energy, which is will be equal to square root of u squared plus k squared, when k will be its global momentum. Okay. Okay. So you see, you have states. You have in an interacting theory, you have many states, and those states are. Characterized, among other things, by their energy at rest. So let us write such a state as such a state. Let us call it a state k. So it a state lambda. Let us say it's labeled by lambda, and it's so. The first state lambda equal one is the one particle state, and then you have lambda equal two, lambda equal three, etc. In fact, you get a continuum, so you have higher energy states of the theory labeled by some. This is just an index. Okay, and such a state has a mass. Well, let me call it m lambda. So m lambda is a state of the energy lambda. Okay. So a state here corresponds to a state lambda with a momentum k. So we can write it as a state lambda, which in addition has a momentum k. And E of these states is given by this formula. See? So this point represents a state lambda with a momentum k. Okay? And in particular, we may consider the rest state, where this state is at rest, and just call it lambda. Lambda is lambda k equals zero. So this is the state lambda. You see? So this is the state one, two, etc. Okay? And so any interacting theory has a spectrum of states lambda plus, of course, their boosted the states corresponding to applying a Lorentz boost to such a state at rest. Okay, and now, you can define what is called the spectral function . The spectral function is a function of mu squared, where mu is just an energy or mass scale. So it's just a number which represents an energy or mass. Remember that Cc equal 1. Energies and mass are expressed in the same unit. And this is simply, well, there is a normalization factor of 2 pi. And then this is simply, you take the sum over all the states at rest of your theory. And at each point, you put a delta function if mu squared is equal to the rest mass squared. See, so If this would be something like that, this would be the density of state. You see, up to a change in mu. It's a delta of the energy minus the energy at rest of the scale. So with a function like that, it would be a density of states. But the density of states is not well defined in relativity quantum field theory, because you always have a continuous of states. After some energy, you can create two particles which moves away. And so you have a continuous of energy. So the density of states is infinite. But instead of just counting the density of states, you may consider this multiplied by the following matrix element. I consider the matrix element between the vacuum of the theory and these states at rest of the phi operator at the origin. And I take the square of this matrix element. Okay? So take this as a definition. So this is a sum for all energy states of the delta function of the energy minus the energy at rest of the corresponding states times the matrix element of the field operator at the origin, because we have to choose a point, so the field operator at the origin, in between the vacuum state of the theory and this excited state. So, of course, the vacuum state here is here. And so, what tells you the Chelin-Lehmann representation? Chelin-Lehmann tells us that the formula for the free theory generalizes for any theory as G8 of K equal the integral over all possible energy from zero to infinity, well, divided by 2p, because we had a factor 4pi here. So integrate over all the possible energies going from zero to infinity. And each time we met a physical state, we add the propagator for this physical state as if it was a free theory, but we multiply by the spectral function. So you see, it means that you can always express the propagator. Let me finish my sentence. You can always express the propagator of an interacting theory as a sum of propagators over all the excited state of the theory. Well, the first, the mass, the one particle state, and then the other particle state of the theory, but weighted by this spectral function, which tell you how this state is coupled to the vacuum state of the theory by the field operator. Yes? Yes. The measure is just d mu squared. So since it's a function of mu squared, I am integrating over d mu squared. But d mu squared is just the standard measure, 2 mu d mu. That's the way it is written, usually. You see? OK? Yes. No, they may be either many particle states or excited state of the particle or bound states. No, I see your question. My answer is that, well, usually in a quantum field theory, there are theorems which tells you that under some assumption of positivity of the Hamiltonian, the lowest energy states above the vacuum is always a single particle. And then the rest is something else. So it comes from some quite serious mathematical theorem that I don't have time to explain. But physically, it's quite intuitive. Well, here we start from a field theory with just one field. So one field is just the way to represent the second quantized system of one particle. So to one field, we associate one particles or, you know, interacting quantum states you built out of this one particle interacting with itself. So to one field, you have one particle. If you have a theory with two fields, you have a theory with two particles, unless you have some symmetry. So for instance, in Maxwell's theory, in fact, you have four fields because you have the four components of the vector potential. So you would expect to have four kind of particle in quantum electrodynamics for the electromagnetic field. In fact, you don't have four because of gauge invariance. You have only two, so two of the states disappear. They are not there because there is a big symmetry. But you have two states, and those two states are, of course, the photon with its two polarization. In fact, you have two kinds of particles in quantum electrodynamics. For the photon, you have the photon with a polarization like that and the photon with a polarization like that. Okay? No, because then it would be the one part. It would be the particle state. No. There are theorem which says that. Let us say, believe me. Okay. It's not something which is quite deep, but I don't have time to explain. But there are theorem which tell you when you have a quantum theory in general. Well, there are exceptions as usual. The lowest energy state is always a state that you can describe in terms of a particle. But it's a theorem which has to do with the representation of the Lorentz group in infinite dimensional algebra and things like that, Hilbert space, etc. Yes?
I didn't quite catch what you were saying about the infinite density of states. You're saying the density of states is infinite, but the spectrum.
Oh, it's just because now, okay, so now think about this mu squared plane, and I try to represent rho of mu squared. See. So you have the first state, a delta function at m squared. And then in general, of course, you have, for instance, you may have a state with you have two particles which moves in the same which are at rest. So these particles has an energy 2m. So here it will be at 4 m squared. But then you may have, so it's at rest, but then you may have the states where you have those two particles move a little bit in the two opposite direction. So that the total momentum of this system, when you have two particles moving in two opposite direction, is zero. So it's still there. But of course, it has an energy 2m plus something, because it has some kinetic energy. So you have a state at 4m, but then you have an infinite, you know. And in fact, you have an infinite number of states like that. So if I represent the density of states, it will be something like that. Well, but what happened is that those states are weakly coupled. So in fact, the spectral density function is a function which turns out to be like that. So the density of states is infinite here because you have an infinite number of states in any given interval of energies. But the density of states, so this is rho of mu squared, the spectral function is finite. That's what I meant. Okay? Okay, so I spent some time to explain that, but that's important because now you see that the lowest energy states, the one particle states here, correspond to a pole in G hat of K. G hat of K has a pole at K squared equal minus mu squared. But remember that K squared is minus the energy squared plus K squared. So it's at a pole at E equals some M. Okay. And the residue of these poles, and close to these poles, it behaves as minus I over K squared plus M squared minus I epsilon times the value of rho of mu here, namely the one particle state, the matrix element of the field operator between the vacuum and the one particle state. Okay? But now this one particle state has no reason to be equal to have a mass equal to the mass of the free particle. You know, we are considering interacting in an interacting theory, you see. So an interacting theory, everything is changed. The spectrum of the theory is different from the free theory. But here is a recipe. Look for the first pole in K squared negative of G hat of K. So G hat of K is a function of K squared from such a formula. So you have you compute the two-point function in momentum space, and you look for its first pole. The value of this first pole, of course, this is m squared here. The value of this first pole gives you the mass of the one particle of the particle lowest energy state of the interacting theory. And the residue tells you, gives you some information of how the field operator couples this one particle state to the vacuum. So in some sense, it tells you when you apply a phi operator on the vacuum, what is the probability to create a particle? You see, this is a probability to create a one particle state when applying the field operator on the vacuum of the theory. You see? Okay, so it took me some time to explain this, but that's very important. And well, in fact, this formula looks like magic for you, but it's not very complicated. And I think, in fact, in the tutorial of this afternoon, you will be able to prove this formula. It's something quite simple. You just apply what you know about what a quantum theory is and what you know about the Lorentz group. What's happening when you apply the energy and the momenta operator on the state of a quantum field theory. So proof, see the tutorial, or good books, like the books by Peskin or the books by Weinberg, but there are hundreds of proofs of this. Okay, so now let us apply this to the phi-4 theory. So now let us consider, go back to the phi-4 theory, where, remember, its action is in Euclidean regime is integral d4x 1/2 of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared plus g over 4 phi-4. And remember, this amounts to a repulsive contact interaction between two particles. What this interaction term tells you, that if you have two particles moving and meeting at some point, two particles of the free theory, two quanta, they behave like B or balls, some pool, and they just knock each other and go away. But this is a quantum process, of course. It's not a classical process. It's a quantum process. Okay. So now let us go back to the problem of that ultraviolet divergences. Yes. So, as soon as physicists in the 30s had built quantum mechanics, they tried to apply it to quantum electrodynamics and to relativistic theories. Of course, you know that, for instance, that Dirac proposed a theory of relativistic particle in 27, I think, but it was a theory just for one particle. One particle with spin, like the electron, yes? Pardon? Yeah. Oh yes. Okay. That's just a normalization. But you're right. I will use this choice. Yes. Thank you. Okay. And so, but people realize that you have problems with the Dirac C. And anyway, since in relativistic quantum theory, in relativity, you can create particle out of energy, you have, in fact, to consider system with an infinite number of particles, namely quantum field theory. And immediately in the 30s, they realized that you have ultraviolet divergence at high energy, or small distances. Okay, and basically from the 30s to the 40s and the 50s, this was considered as one of the big problems of quantum theory when applied to high energy physics. And the problem was solved in this domain. And in fact, it was really completely understood at the end of the 70s. Well, at the beginning of the 70s. Okay. So, and that's a problem of the theory of renormalization. So, why are there ultraviolet divergences? Well, it's simply because, remember, first, the first diagram we had everywhere when we were computing perturbative expansion of correlation functions, so vacuum expectation value of products of operator, like this one, we always met this beast, this little tadpole diagrams, which in fact represent the expectation value in the vacuum of phi zero squared. And we have seen that this is infinite for, well, two equivalent reasons. First, we have seen that phi of x, phi of zero behaves like x to the power 2 minus the dimension of space. And therefore, as soon as d is larger or equal to 2, this is infinite at x equals 0. There is a log of x at d equal 2. But that's, so it's also divergent, so it's a minus log of x, it's not important. Another way, so this is how to see the divergence at small distances. But from the Feynman rules that you have already met in QFT1 theory, you can represent, or using just this representation for the free theory, you have seen that phi of zero can be rewritten as integral over d dk of 2 pi to the power k, 1 over k squared plus m squared. And this is divergent at large k. This integral is divergent at large scale. Okay. And the other important diagram that we met, let me call this the bubble diagram. Bubble diagram that we met in the calculation of the four-point function of the theory. So it gives information about the interaction between the particles in the interacting theory. It contains this irreducible part. So this irreducible part, if you want to call x and y the two-point, correspond to phi of x, phi of y squared. And this behaves like, of course, x minus y to the power 2 times 2 minus d. Or in Fourier transform, if I write this object as integral d dp of some function b of p, let us say, e to the ip x minus y, if p is a momentum, the Feynman rules tell you that this b of p, you have momentum, which carry, well, let me draw this diagram in more details. From the Feynman rules you already learned in the QFT1 course, if you have a momentum p here coming on, a four momentum, if you assume that here you have a momentum k, internal momentum carrying, and here you have an internal momentum p plus k, b of p is simply the propagator for this object times the propagator for this object, which is p plus k, so the sum of the two momenta, the internal momenta k and the external momenta k plus m squared. And you have to integrate this object over d dk divided by 2p over k. So k is the internal momenta, internal momentum, and p is the external momentum. But this formula is just a way to rewrite the Fourier transform of the products of two propagators, while the propagators are written by the Fourier transform. And you see immediately that this behaves at large p, at large k, as d dk over k to the 4 at large k. And this is divergent if d is larger or equal to 4. You see? Yes?
Should the denominator be 2 pi to the d?
2 pi to the d. Yes, yes, I'm very sorry. Well, it was so badly written that it could have been a d. But you are right. But this normalization factor is not important to see the divergence. You see? Okay. So this was the first example, and there are many, many others. It's a very general problem that you get big problems if you just apply the rule of perturbation theory and try to compute boldly. So, what are the solutions to treat this problem? I will show you the, how you deal with that problem, but before that, let me introduce the concept of regularization, because it has been a very important step and it's still a very important trick to study and to master those ultraviolet divergences. Regularization means change the quantum theory. At high energies, energy or high momenta, so that it is better behaved but unchanged at low energy. And see what are the properties of this theory and see whether when you study that you can find a procedure where this modification goes away. So regularization means change the quantum theory at high energy and renormalization will mean, so basically that's we assume that if the energy is larger than some energy scale lambda, which is called an ultraviolet regulator, the theory changes. And renormalization means, can we make sense of a limit lambda goes to infinity, keeping keeping sensible results for the quantum theory. See? Okay. So why, where does this idea of changing the high energy behavior of theory comes from? Well, it comes, in fact, it's very old because first, for instance, you can use the, so I give just a few examples without explaining at all what it is. But one of the idea is, in fact, the first idea that, in some sense, changing the momentum at high energy, in fact, comes from the fact that space or space-time is a lattice. So instead of having a continuous space-time, you assume that there is some very tiny structure of space-time which makes it like a lattice or some kind of lattice. It doesn't have to be a regular lattice. Okay? And that's a very old idea. In fact, the idea was first suggested by Heisenberg as soon as 1930s, and but it was for strong interaction for understanding the properties of the proton, so it didn't work very well. He tried again in 31, etc. So it was an idea which was not working very well, but it became very important in 74 because Wilson, Ken Wilson, applied it to gauge theories, where it became a very important tool to study by with computer non-abelian gauge theories. Okay, so that's the first idea. And the first, in this case, you have a lattice. It has a minimal distance A, minimal distance A. And of course, this minimal distance plays the role of the inverse of this maximal energy by through the uncertainty relation. Now, the second and a bit more precise idea is to just state that the momenta of this any theory are smaller than a large distance cutoff. So here I introduce a minimal length. Here I introduce a maximal energy or momentum. Okay? And that's an idea which is, of course, not that far from that. And it was introduced, I think, and started to be used very seriously by Paoli and Vidar around 1949 or something like that. But it has been used before in the quantization of QED by Feynman and then other people. So, and then there is a third proposal, which is magic. It is considered that the dimension of space, time, D, is not an integer, but it's 4 minus epsilon, where epsilon is a small number, or even a complex number. And this is called as dimensional regularization. And it looks like a crazy idea, but it has a lot of nice mathematical and physical properties. And it has been used both in statistical mechanics and in gauge theories, because, for instance, it was used, it was not invented by Toft and Veltman, but in 74 or 72 or 3, I don't know, 72. They use it to show that gauge theories are indeed renormalizable, at least at one loop. So it was a very important ingredient. And finally, there is in fact a fourth reason to use regularization, which is simply that we know that anyway, in the actual world, there is a minimal length, which is a Planck's length. So there is an A, which is analog to the Planck length. And equivalent to there is a maximum lambda, which is a Planck's max, Planck mass. And we know that beyond this minimal length or this minimal length, well, perhaps quantum mechanics still applies, but clearly the world of strong quantum gravity will not be described by a single local quantum field theory, because the concept of space and of time is not expected to exist anymore. And you will see in the lecture in quantum gravity and the lecture in string theory that people are trying very hard, and they have a lot of very nice ideas to replace the concept of space-time, of continuous space-time, but something more quantum. So anyway, all what we are doing when we are doing calculation in quantum field theories, where we assume that space and time is local, and that momenta and energies are also continuous variables, breaks down in some way beyond the Planck scale. So in the physical world, there is indeed a regularization which is provided by gravity. Okay. But we don't know really yet very well what this regularization is and what this regularization means, I think. Okay, so. So in the rest of this lecture, I will mainly use the assumption that there is just a maximal energy, and that beyond this maximal energy, nothing is defined. We can assume that in all our calculation, the momenta are smaller than some lambda. Okay. And then what you will see is that, of course, let me assume that now, from now on, I assume that I'm in four dimensions of space-time, and I assume that the momenta are always smaller than this lambda. So, okay. So I use the second idea. This kind of regularization. Then, yes?
If we're assuming D equals 4, then why did we introduce the magic dimension?
No, no. I am using this regularization trick in four dimensions. This is another regularization trick, which assumes to make calculation in a dimension which is not 4, because in that case, the ultraviolet divergence disappear magically, but they are replaced by something else. But of course, they reappear when the dimension is 4. In fact, in this, if the dimension is assumed to be 4 minus epsilon, and you take the physical limit epsilon goes to 0, the ultraviolet divergence reappear, of course, because you understand anything, but you get poles in 1 over epsilon in the amplitude. So you get ultraviolet poles in the dimension. But now, let me just assume that I am in 4 dimension. I have put a sharp energy momentum cutoff. Okay. And then it's easy to see that this diagram, let me consider this diagram, and let me consider, which is, of course, correspond. So this is something that I will call T of M, because it's a diagram of the tadpole. And it is given mathematically by this expression, d4k over 2 pi to the power k, 1 over k squared plus m squared. I am integrating over 4-dimensional Euclidean momenta. And simply, I am integrating over all the momenta which are less than this lambda. So I am integrating over a big ball in 4-dimensional momentum space instead of infinite momentum space. Okay? I'm sorry, this is a small m. Yes, sorry. Thank you. Okay? Of course, so we have seen that there is a divergence. And if you do the calculation, and that's an exercise that you will do later on, you find that the divergence is proportional to lambda squared. Of course, because you have a power 4 of the momenta in the measure and a power of 2 of the momenta of minus 2 in the denominator. So this should behave like a momentum to the power 2, this integral. So the divergence has to be proportional to lambda squared. And if you do a bit of calculation of spherical integrals, you find that the coefficient of in front of that is 1 over 4 pi squared. Okay? So it's just a calculation. And then, of course, you may say, haha, but there are some corrections. And if you compute the correction, you discover that there is also a logarithm of lambda squared divergence. But it is proportional to m squared divided by 4 pi squared. Plus, you have term over the 1. So you have a leading divergence, which is quadratic. And you have a subleading divergence, which is proportional to the logarithm of lambda squared, but which is proportional to m squared, because this has to be equal to, this must have the dimension of a mass. And in fact, you would say, what is the log of an energy? What is the log of an electron of an electron volt? Or what is the log of a joule? I don't know. What we know is we know what is the log of 1, the log of 2, the log of 3, but I don't know what is the log of an energy or the log of a distance. Of course, in order for this to make sense, it has to be a ratio of the two momentum or energy scale in this integral, which are the mass and which are the sharp energy momentum cutoff. So it has to be lambda squared over m squared. Okay, so I give you the results, but well, the only difficult part is to compute those two coefficients. But it's not very complicated to do that, but I give you the results. Okay. So you see that if lambda is finite, this contribution of this diagram is very big, but it's finite. And then you have a correction which is proportional to mass, which is also divergent with lambda, but which diverges only like a logarithm. Okay? And now let us consider this bubble diagram here, which I call B. B depends both on the momentum and the mass, because you have a momentum P, a 4 momentum, which goes inside. We have seen that the divergence, but the divergence term is a log. We expect that it's a log because we have a d4k over k4, so we expect to have a log squared. Again, we expect to have a log lambda squared over something. But in that case, for this integral, you have two other energy momentum scale. You have the mass and you have the momentum. So I don't make this precise. And if you do the calculation, you have 4 pi squared. And then you have terms over the one. So which terms which are finite when lambda goes to infinity. Remember? So these tadpole diagrams have a quadratic divergence. It is called the quadratic divergence. Quadratic divergence. And the bubble diagrams has only a logarithmic divergence. Okay. Good. And now, once we have these results, here comes the idea of renormalization. First front. Okay. The idea of The idea of renormalization means that, in fact, now we go back to the 5-4 theory, and we are interested is what is the physical mass? What is the physical mass of the particle in the 5-4 theory? Okay. So, in order to do that, well, we have just to use the Chalon-Lehmann representation and to look at the pole of the full propagator. Okay? So, yes?
What in our previous discussion motivates our question about the mass of the particle?
Because I am interested in a quantum theory, which is a theory of particles which interacts. So I'm, the first naive question is, what is the spectrum of this theory? And, well, this discussion tells you there should be some divergence when I compute the mass. But now that I've introduced a sharp cutoff regulator, I expect that the mass will be finite. So let us compute this mass. See? Okay. So for that, we just have to compute the propagator. So let us compute the propagator simply in Euclidean spacetime because we don't have the I factor, but the Chalon-Lehmann representation will be exactly the same formula without the I. If I compute the Euclidean propagator, okay? So let me compute the Euclidean propagator of k, and which is given by this, and minus, remember, g is a 1/2 times this diagram plus term of order p squared. Okay? And I expect that it behaves like 1 over k squared plus m squared close to the first particle states. So instead of computing ge of k, let me compute the inverse of ge of k, which turns out to be the term over the 2 in phi of the effective action. Remember that last time I explained to you that phi phi is the inverse of the second derivative of the effective action. So, and this is, of course, will be, so this is 1 over p squared plus m squared. So I will get k squared plus m squared. And if I expand this, I get plus g instead of minus g, because this is 1 over k squared plus m squared minus g over 2, 1 over k squared plus m squared squared, because you have two propagators and t of m. So this will be, if I invert and keep only the term which are first order in g, so this is k squared plus m squared, I get a plus g over 2 because I invert something minus g. The k squared plus m squared disappear, and I get t of m plus term of order g squared. You see? And so, what is the physical mass? It is correspond to a pole in g of k. So the physical mass correspond to a pole in g of k. So it's given by a zero of the inverse, which I'll call gamma 2 of k. This given by this formula. So what is the zero of gamma 2 of k? It is, of course, given by the value of minus k squared. Remember that the pole is k squared is minus m squared here. So the physical mass is given by, I call it m physical squared. This is given by the, I'm sorry, this is a little m. It's m squared plus g 1/2 t of m. You see? And t of m, remember, depend on lambda. So this is t of m and of lambda, which is of order lambda squared. So you see that the fact that T of m is diverge when big lambda means that the physical mass, this means that if m is of order 1, then the physical mass is of order lambda, very large. So the ultraviolet divergence signals the fact that when I'm doing the calculation to first order in the Kuplik constant, the physical mass of the particle is infinite or is very large if I have an ultraviolet cutoff. But you see also that the physical mass, and that's something which of course had to be expected, is different from m. M was the mass in the action, and the physical mass is different from the parameter in the action, because you have to sum all quantum processes to get the physical mass. You see? So the fact that the physical mass is different from the mass which is in the action, so this is a parameter in the action, means that the mass is renormalized. Quantum effects change the mass with respect to the mass of the original classical action. And that's something to be expected. But the problem is that this renormalization is infinite. It's not finite. Now, you might think a little bit about Why the mass is renormalized and why is this renormalization infinite? And there is a simple physical picture of, I can give you a physical picture of mass renormalization. Which is quite simple. Remember, classically, we have our theory. We have a theory where we have particles of mass m. M, which simply repels each other. Contact. Repulsive interaction. They are free to move, except that when they're at the same place, they repel each other. So they behave like beer balls, if you want. Now, so, but anyway, classically, if you have a particle of mass m at rest, it's just a particle of mass m at rest, and it has an energy proportion equal to the mass. The energy of a configuration of a particle at rest is a particle with an energy E equal m, c squared, but c squared equal 1 in my calculation. Now, in the quantum theory, we still have particles of mass m. They have particle interaction, but we are in a quantum theory. And we are in a quantum theory, so it means that there are quantum fluctuations. In particular, there are quantum fluctuations in the vacuum of the theory. In the vacuum state of the theory. Which means that you have this picture that I think you have heard and met and even saw picture of that in fact the vacuum is not empty. The vacuum is some kind of gas of virtual particles. So in the vacuum, you have a lot of virtual particles. You have virtual particles popping out and then annihilating out of the vacuum. So if you look at a little piece of a vacuum with a microscope, you will find some probability to have some particles. Okay, that's simply the quantum fluctuation of the vacuum. Okay. Okay, but so the vacuum is a vacuum. It has a lot of virtual particles in it, but it's still the lowest energy state. So it is a vacuum, but it has quantum properties. Now imagine that you add to the vacuum a particle of mass m. So you consider not the vacuum, but the one particle state of your quantum theory. So you have a particle here, and all around you have the vacuum, and around the vacuum, you have your virtual particles, which pops out, move a little bit, annihilates, pops out, move a little bit, etc. Okay, so that's fine, except that if some virtual particles appear in the vicinity of the real particle, here I have a real particle, physical particle. They have some probability to hit the particle. It costs energy. So they are repelled by the vacuum. So the virtual particles are repelled by the real particles. So you have less particles, less virtual particles near the real particles than far away from the particles. And this costs energy, because each time the virtual particles hit the real particles, it costs energy because you have a repulsive contact interaction. So this means that the real one particle states is the particle M surrounded by some kind of bubble of modified vacuum, if you want. This is very, very qualitative. It's almost science fiction, but it's just a physical picture of modified vacuum where you have less particles, but this modified vacuum has a higher energy density than the ordinary vacuum. Okay? And therefore, in fact, the one particle state of the theory is not the single particle with a mass m, it's a single particle of the mass m surrounded, so it's by this region where the vacuum state is different. And this surrounding has also some energy. Yes?
So I believe I see why virtual particles would be less likely to appear around the real particle because
they are repelled.
Right.
Yes.
Because of the repulsion costs energy, as you said.
Yes.
So if virtual particles appear, if a significant number were to appear around the real particle, then there would be higher energy. So fewer virtual particles appear around the real particle. So how come the modified vacuum has higher energy density?
Well, that's the result. In fact, the calculation, the rigorous calculation, that is a rigorous way to compute this effect. So for me, it's quite clear, but I agree, it's a bit... in order really to get convinced of that, you do this calculation.
That showed us that the mass in the action is not the physical mass.
Yes, so this means that the mass in the action is not the physical mass, because the mass of the real one particle state is the mass of the one particle plus the energy of the surrounding region. Where the particles has an influence of the vacuum. And this costs energy.
Since the renormalization is infinite, are you saying that the higher energy density in that bubble is due to that?
Yeah, and now, this is the renormalization effect. It explains to you why there is a correction, and it explains to you why the correction is positive. It's positive because there is a plus G, and there is a plus G because G positive corresponds to repulsive effect. If the interaction was attractive, if you had virtual particles popping out, they would be attracted by the real particle, and the real particle would act as a sink of particles. And this would be very, very problematic because it means that the theory is unstable. So the fact that you have a positive thing here reflects the fact that the interaction is repulsive, okay? And now the fact that is infinite. So in some sense, the energy is the mass plus some delta m, which count this. So the mass is the particle, and this is the contribution of what's happening around the particle. You see? And in fact, that's an effect which is already purely classical. There is a nice experiment that if you have a ball in your tub, in a glass of water with some radius, and you try to move it, for instance, you look at at how it moves under the Archimede force when it goes up to the top of the ball, you see. If you apply the rules, if you compute, just you compute the Archimedes force on a ball and apply Newton's law to compute the acceleration of the ball, you do not get the correct law for the speed of the ball. Why is it so? It's because when a ball moves away, it has to change the currents of the water inside. So in fact, the balls carry with itself some water. And the mass of a ball, if you want, the mass of a ball, a real ball, moving in water, just solving the Navier-Stokes equation, it's very classic, completely classical hydrodynamics, you find that the mass of the ball moving in water is the mass of the ball itself, plus a correction, taking into account the fact that the mass has to carry some of the water with it. And that's an effect of renormalization, which is purely classical. Yes? Yes.
This is more or less a weighted average of all the
yes.
Excited states.
Yes.
Then you do the approximation once to the one particle state.
Yes.
And then you compute the inverse of GE.
No, but it's the same. It's just because that's exactly the same. Because simply, remember, if I write that 1 over GE is this propagator plus G over 2 times these diagrams, it's equivalent to state that GE is the free propagator minus G 1/2 times this. But if I expand 1 over something plus something, I get, I'm sorry, this is P squared plus M squared. I guess this is 1 over p squared plus m squared minus 1 over p squared plus m squared. So I can rewrite this as p squared plus m squared times 1 plus 1 over p squared plus m squared g over 2 times this diagram. So now I expand. Yes. Yes. Yes.
I mean, was it, does it have any effect when you do this approximation on the
whole? Well, here I find you, okay, so let me, okay, let me go again. If I found, see, if I take the physical mass to be this, I found that G, so once I've done that, I found that GE of k is simply 1 over k squared plus m physical squared plus term of order g squared that I neglect because I'm doing calculation at one loop. So you see that this m physical is the mass of the one particle states, and the fact that I get the factor 1 here means that at linear order in the coupling constant, this term is not changed.
But what's the order of the higher excited mass, the mu there?
There will be higher. For instance, there will be typically larger than 4m squared.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
what's
but
the order of that kind of thing? I mean, how do you say that?
What do you mean by the order? No, it will contribute, but when k squared is very close to minus m squared, this is a dominant term because this is very small.
I'm going to say that the term you drop, what's the effect? I mean, what's the order of that effect?
The effect will be simply to change a little bit the propagator. But as long as k squared is very close to minus m squared, the dominant term is this one, because this term is very small. So if you want, if I write as a function of minus k squared, the which is the energy, if you want. If I write g of e, remember that k squared is minus e squared plus etc. I start from something at origin. Then I have a pole, something with divergence at m physical squared. And then you have, and probably you will have some other things, etc., associated to the higher energy states. And you have, okay. But this singularity, so this divergence, corresponds to the first physical state. And I'm only interested in what's happening here. You see? So of course, if I am going to see what's happening in the higher energy, then I must take into account the higher states, energy states of the theory. They are also of order g squared. No, but what I mean is that they will be of order g squared. What this kind of calculation tells you that at order g, you still get a theory described by just one particle, and it's just the mass of the particle which is renormalized. But when you go to order g squared, of course, then you start to feel the contribution of the other particles. And that's because, remember, for instance, at leading order, you had these diagrams. At second order, you had such a diagram, and you had this diagram. Okay? If you want to think about what this diagram represents, the particle here moving in space. These diagrams represent a particle moving in the space, but precisely these diagrams, if you think about what it represents in space-time, it represents a virtual process where a pair of a particle and its antiparticles, but we are in a scalar field, so no spin, no charge, so the particle is its own antiparticles. So these diagrams represent, in fact, physically, a pair of virtual particles popping out in the vacuum and then disappearing while interacting with a particle. Or if you prefer, you have a pair of particles here, a pair of virtual particles which appear. One of them interacts with the real particles, and then it annihilates with the other virtual particles. Here, it's the same thing, but a bit more complicated. But in this process, you see, in this process, you have real particles which, because of a quantum excitation, I think I should raise that a little bit. You have a particle of mass m, which, because of a quantum virtual process, creates three particles. So here, you have one particle. Here, you have three particles. So it's precisely a state, virtual states, because the energy is not conserved in such a process, but it's a virtual, it's a quantum fluctuation. It's something which is which lies somewhere here. So this is a one particle state. This is a two particle state. And somewhere here, you have contribution of three particle states. You see? So these diagrams, which is an order, a diagram of order g squared, starts to feel what's going on here, but only at second order in g squared. Does this answer your question? Why? Yes. Yes. You?
Yes. Just keep one term, right? From the
Yeah, it's a term which comes just from the first.
Yeah. Yeah. Put one more term there.
Those the one.
Yeah.
You want? Well, but yes, but then if you put all the terms, they will give you term of order 1 over k squared plus mu squared with mu squared larger or equal to 4m squared.
Yeah.
So they give very small contribution compared to these terms if you are looking at what's happening here.
But I think in this case, if you got a 4m squared term there,
yes,
you get an order g correction in the
normalization. You might, and in general, you do. But it turns, for a general theory, you do. But it turns out for the 5-4 theory, you don't. That's a property of the 5-4 theory. That's because you only have a diagram like that, and you don't have diagrams like that, which represent intermediate many particle states. So it's a particular, it's a special to 5-4 theory. If you have only mass renormalization, is special to 5-4 theory. Do you understand? You do the calculation, and you find that the only process which counts at one loop is given by this diagram, which just renormalized the mass of the one particle states at that order. At some point, this is a general result, which is valid for any quantum field theory. So you do have example of quantum field theory where the situation is more complicated. But for the 5-4 theory, you do the calculation, and you know, a quantum theory is a physical theory. You can think in general, but at some point you have to do calculation. You do the calculation, and for 5-4, you find only this diagram. You see? That's the result of the calculation. Okay, so let me just finish the idea of renormalization by stating that I still have this blackboard. I'm going late, but so now the idea of renormalization is the following. So remember, I stated that regularization means we modify the theory. So for instance, we introduce a sharp energy cutoff. Renormalization means, can we make sense of a limit where this regularization disappears, keeping sensible result? And here, renormalization is something very simple. Renormalization means I take the lambda goes to infinity limit, keeping the physical mass fixed, because after all, that's what I'm interested. I'm interested in seeing whether there exists a quantum theory of an interacting scalar field with particles with a given mass. So you see. So, and that's of course very possible, because if I do that, I simply have to take the limit lambda goes to infinity and m squared equal m physical squared minus g over 2 t of m. T of m and of lambda. Which to that order, since the relation between little m and m physical is over the g, can be replaced by m physical squared minus g over 2 t of m physical and of lambda plus term of order chi squared. And of course, you see in that situation that m squared is m physical minus something negative, so it goes to minus infinity. But if I take this limit, the two-point function is finished, and the two-point function of my theory, g of k, is 1 over k squared plus m physical squared. So this is the idea of renormalization. The idea is that in order to define a sensible quantum field theory, you simply have to define the theory in such a way that the physical parameter makes sense, are finite, when this intermediate tool you have introduced goes to infinity. So in this idea, you get a finite two-point function. But now a two-point function at one loop. So this is a two-point function of a quantum theory. It's not very different from the quantum for the two-point function of the free theory. But now this is a two-point function of a quantum theory. And so you see that the parameter m in the action and the parameter lambda are just intermediate parameter. In the functional integral, remember everything was computed from a functional integral, d phi e minus s of phi, phi phi. That's how I compute the two-point function, and there is that. To have something which is finite, which corresponds to the physical matrix element of a physical quantum theory, well, it's not as simple as in quantum mechanics, where you can just take the classical action and compute the functional integral. You have to adjust the coefficient of the action so that you get a sensible result. So there are just intermediate parameters in the functional integral. M is called a bare mass parameter. And what you have to do is to do some fine tuning of the bare parameter when taking the limit lambda goes to infinity, which is called the continuum limit. In order to get a renormalized theory which is finite. So this is the idea behind renormalization in this framework of perturbation theory. Okay, and so it's time, last time to end, but tomorrow we'll see that we can do the same procedure, works for the four-point function. Remember that the four-point function had this bubble diagram, which has a logarithmic divergence, and we'll see that here we had to renormalize the mass. For the four-point function, we had to renormalize the coupling constant, g. So not only is the mass of the particle renormalized through this kind of process, but the coupling constant, which describes what's happening when you have two particles which can come together, is also modified by the existence of fluctuation of the vacuum. But this will work, but that's, we shall do that tomorrow.